that's been our show. Thanks again for listening, and thank you again, caller. I'm sorry I forgot to get your name for that great request from Half Japanese. Great band.
Thank you, caller, and thank you, listeners. Feel free to call or text next time. We'll be back next week, same time.
All right. Until then, good night.
Good night.
The station you're listening to is powered by AzuraCast, the free and open source software that makes web radio simple. If you're hearing this message, your station's ready to go. Just add new music to your playlists. If you need help or to learn more about AzuraCast, visit azuracast.com.
This has been a rebroadcast of our August 12th program.
Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Norman, your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Infections like polio, smallpox, and measles used to be as common as coronaviruses today. But now we have life-saving vaccines for those and other diseases. Sadly, too many children still go unvaccinated. Choosing to delay or refuse vaccine puts your child and other children at serious risk. So talk to your child's doctor today about vaccines. And for more information, visit aawellnessproject.org.
Breast cancer calls to mind self-exams and mammograms. But did you know the most fatal form of breast cancer does not
have a lump? No lump. Still cancer. You heard me right. No lump can still be cancer. Inflammatory breast cancer, IBC, does not show up
on a mammogram and often strikes women in their 30s.
So learn about IBC. Any sudden change in the breast is cause for a full and proper exam.
www.theibcnetwork.org or find them at the IBC Network Inflammatory Breast Cancer on Facebook.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Music. For your inner robot.
in old Frisco. A pretty little chick wherever you go.
Yeah. the Jag slide into the curve. I know I'll never forget that horrible sight. I guess I found out for myself that everyone was right.
You all come back from the
Did you know that Lyme disease is the most prevalent tick-borne illness, with about 220,000 new cases occurring each year? Believe it or not, you can test negative for Lyme and still be infected. Many victims of Lyme report never seeing a bullseye rash, and it can be very difficult to diagnose because it mimics other illnesses, such as multiple sclerosis, ALS, and Alzheimer's. To learn more, go to www.LymeDiseaseAssociation.org.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Richard Gordon, and she's...
Riona Duncan.
And we're here with two fine professors of our acquaintance to talk about some translation issues.
We have Christopher Jones, who's Professor Emeritus of French and Francophone Studies at Carnegie Mellon. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
So glad to have you here. And we also have Marcy Persine, who's Assistant Professor and Director of Undergraduate Studies in Classics down at Pitt.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much.
I just got to start by saying I knew that Christopher had been all over the place and learning all sorts of different languages, but I was amazed when I just learned that he got to Portugal to play pro basketball, and he had one word in Portuguese.
That's correct. And it was an eye-opener going to Portugal after having been a very poor student of German, and I still have no German, but being dropped into a bath of a foreign language and at a time when there were very few English speakers in Portugal. So it was sink or swim, so to speak, and I swam.
As hard as it is for us to understand each other when we speak the same language, what the heck happens once you start adding different languages?
Increased difficulty, I think, but also increased opportunity for communication to happen, right? So there's some places where languages can meet the needs that another language doesn't realize it has. So, for example, you might think of how in Japanese there's a particular word for someone who is an upperclassman who might be a mentor figure for you, a senpai. We don't have an equivalent like that in English, which can make things kind of difficult, like when you're trying to refer to someone who is a third-year graduate student and you're a mere first-year graduate student and utterly lost in the sauce. It can be nice to be able to refer to someone who has advanced experience than you, but English doesn't have any such word.
Wait, you're a classics professor and you're telling us about words in modern Japanese?
Well, that's not, I don't know very much Japanese. Maybe someday, though.
It is true that many languages have these levels. In Japanese, it's honorifics, but in Chinese and in Latin languages, there's familiar and formal ways of address, which for Americans can be somewhat problematic. But we do eventually adapt if we're planning to integrate ourselves into the culture.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it can lead to interesting problems and opportunities, even in classics. So I remember going to a lecture some years ago by Professor Jin Yu Lu, who was in the middle of translating some of Ovid's love letters into Japanese. And in Latin, it is very rare to use personal pronouns because it's an inflected language. So the verbs contain the concept of who is doing an action. So you don't need to use to very often or vos very often. It's implied in the verb. But the very first word, when you translate into Japanese, a love poem that begins with, you are so beautiful, needs to be one of these levels of familiarity. Is it anata? Is it anta? Or is it something more formal than that? And I remember just being blown away by her lecture on this.
Going back to Americans learning other languages, do you think Americans are worse than other cultures at learning language? Because I've heard that from various people.
you often hear it from Americans themselves, right? Oh, I'm bad at languages and so forth, not naming any names. I think learning languages is, there is an aptitude. I don't think there's any research that shows that any particular cultural group is better or worse than another at learning languages. But then you get around to need. If you need to learn a language, myself arriving in Portugal and being interviewed by a journalist needing someone to interpret, then going into a small town where there was an American pastor who spoke English, and that was it. The need, and I got it by then also, but how many Americans in their kind of daily life need to learn another language? Some, you know, if you're working in the medical fields, even sometimes in law and places like that where at least you might need a decent knowledge of Spanish. In the courts, you somehow need to be able to communicate in English what a witness may have only been able to express in Ukrainian or something like that. I mean, that's, so there is need there, but it's not a broad, a large need among Americans generally. And without getting into the fact that the world speaks English now, that makes us worse students of language.
One of the things that I think affects it is fear of failure. I didn't take French or Italian or Spanish or German. I stuck with Latin, which was taught to me as a dead language. Sorry.
Yeah, but, no, it, I understand.
But it was a fear of failure. I didn't want mm-hmm. to do this. And mm-hmm. when my son and I took a trip to Germany, I got along with the shopkeepers better than he did, even though he was studying German, because he was too scared to make a mistake.
Right, absolutely. When, this is an anecdote, but when I was in college, I was fortunate enough to live with two of my best friends, who I'm still very good friends with. And one of them, her primary language was Spanish, and she spoke Spanish with her family. And my other friend's primary language was Taiwanese. And I remember moving in with them and saying, hey, wouldn't it be great if I could improve my Spanish with you and start to learn Cantonese with you? And then both of them, as one, basically turned to me and said, it would be too much work. We want to actually be your friend, not your teachers. Right? So there's this space for failure. There's, you know, the question of how you can immerse yourself. There's the urgency, the need to learn. And then there's also this ease of communication by having what's often referred to as a lingua franca, right, which English serves as a lingua franca in the U.S. And so some people might accuse Americans of being lazy by defaulting to English, but actually a lot of times it allows us to cut through these difficulties of, oh, that's not the word that you mean. I'm not looking for that word. I'm not going to correct your grammar. We're going to have the conversation instead. But it is a lost opportunity as well. And at the end of 2 years of living with these two folks, my friend who was trying desperately not to teach me Cantonese finally capitulated enough to teach me how to say "wobu dojowe," which means I don't speak Mandarin.
Je m'appelle Richard, je ne comprends pas français, you know?
Je parle un peu de français. Mais c'est terrible.
Another difficulty, I think, in translation is when it gets beyond even just the literal, like, what word do you get to correct, and gets more into translating poetry. How have you guys experienced that?
Translation of works of art, whether it's poetry, fiction, and then, of course, there are other areas of translation like law, contract law, for example. I've had an experience with that. But poetry, song, fiction, we really have all these, not just linguistic elements, but cultural elements. So word-to-word translations are often ridiculous, and really do not carry the meaning in any significant way. And a couple of examples that occurred to me, I don't know whether you've ever read Montalbano, the Inspector Montalbano, who is a Sicilian, written by a guy named Camilleri, who writes in this extremely idiosyncratic Sicilian dialect. Where do you start? I'm a translator. I speak perfectly adequate English. And it's Midwestern English, which is to say Tom Brokaw's English, i.e. the standard English, if there is such a thing in the U.S. And I'm going to translate this Sicilian writer who writes in a Sicilian dialect, which is strange even to Italians. Where do you start? First of all, there's all the aspects of the culture itself, everything from dress, interaction between the sexes, food, daily life, and all that other kind of stuff. But then you have to somehow get across to an English speaker this dialect, which is non-standard. Now, he has been translated into like a Jersey dialect, you know, some sort of really heavy New York area dialect, you know, with all this kind of weird expressions and so forth, which is a legitimate effort,
right,
to take that across. Mm-hmm. Now, poetry is a whole different story, and song, which is, of course, my principal area of expression these days. For example, I just did, which Richard has, a CD in French, working with a poet from Montreal. Mm-hmm. And I did translations of his texts. I wrote some myself in French. And we just gave a presentation up in Quebec City on this and what it meant and what my translations were. And my translations were de sens, of the sense. Mm-hmm. It was not possible without another year to attempt to write his texts into an English song with the same music and so forth. And that's almost never done because of the level of difficulty,
right,
both cultural and the additional complication of music, and then you know, the demands of rhyme and colloquial expression and all those sorts of things. It's really complicated.
I think terribly. I think I've seen the closest I've seen to that is, you know, besides your record Montreal Encore, is if you go to the opera and there are super titles, mm-hmm, in your language while they're singing in the original language,
right,
or if they're singing in whatever the language is of the audience as opposed to the original that it was written in.
Right. And thinking about your experience with music, Christopher, it reminded me of Louis Armstrong's translation of Yonkers, which is dissonance, right? It's not word for word. And when you try to translate music sensibly, you have the understructure of music itself, right? So you get the jazz undertones. You know that it's a love song when you start listening to it, whether it's Louis singing it or Edith Piaf. And turning to Riona's question to think about poetry can be very difficult, as you highlighted, Christopher, but we do have, just like in music, the song that supports it, the melody, the instrumentation. In poetry, you have the meter, the rhyme scheme, the vocabulary decisions. And, you know, in classics, one of the places where this becomes fun and interesting and difficult and problematic is the age of the text that you're looking at, because so many people want or expect to open a translation of, say, the Aeneid or the Iliad and be met with something that sounds like Shakespeare to them, something that is archaic and grand and maybe bombastic. Virgil's Latin is fairly bombastic, but Homer's Greek is very readable, and it paces very quickly, and it has this beautiful flow to it, which is so difficult to put into English meter in a way that doesn't sound heavy or difficult, and we have all of these names to wrestle with. and all of these epithets and formulae that feel very alien to American poetic forms, right? So why is he always swift-footed Achilles or horse-tail-helmeted Hector, which all of those things just feel very burdensome to us, whereas we would just say Hector came on, and we would have other alliterations and descriptions.
Well, Marcy, one of the things that Riona told me about you that I just am fascinated about is that one of your areas especially is that period of time when Latin and Greek coexisted at the top of the European pyramid.
Yes, yes. So my area of specialty is Roman satire, especially early Roman satire. So Riona and I got to talking in the course of this Latin class that we engaged in, which was an epic Latin class, but an epic Latin class not on the Aeneid, but on its predecessor, which is a fragmentary text called the Annales. And we were looking at this time period in Roman history, which is roughly the end of the 3rd century BCE into the 2nd century BCE, when Rome starts to become an empire, even as it remains governmentally a republic. But one of the first places that Rome colonizes is Greece, just across the Tyrrhenian. And what's so interesting about this is that in many ways, the Italian peninsula had already been Greek, right? So Naples, for example, was a Greek colony. And Ischia, as we know it now, was already a Greek colony. So Naples is Neapolis in Greek, or the new city. So even before Rome formally triumphs over Macedon and takes over the Greek mainland, the people who speak Latin are side by side, neighbors, poets in common, philosophers in common with people who speak Greek. And these languages are so closely related to one another, but to come back full circle, they're also not quite fully mutually intelligible. They use different scripts, they have different vocabulary. It's not different from, say, a Spanish speaker who goes to Portugal and can understand maybe 60 to 70% of what's going on, but is still missing nuances and still struggles to get the pronunciation right, etc. So it's a fun period of time because there's so much happening politically in the space, and there are all of these ways in which the Romans are trying to navigate this new prestige that they have over these neighbors that previously had dominated the Mediterranean. So they're grappling with this newfound power, whereas the Greeks are on the opposite side of things. They're trying to understand how they've lost these wars, who these neighbors are. Are they actually Greeks after all? They speak a very similar language to us. And this is something that Dionysius of Halicarnassus, for example, says, oh, it's okay that we were conquered by the Romans. The Romans are actually Greeks.
I don't think of Greek and Latin or Greek and Italian as similar.
Greek and Italian are pretty distant, especially modern Greek and modern Italian.
Okay.
So the linguistic journeys of those two languages through phonetic vowel shifts in particular have made them incredibly distinct languages in the contemporary world. But if you were to map out the Indo-European family tree, for example, you would put Greek and Latin as close branches on the same bough.
Would you say that, you know, the Latins are Greek because they speak a similar language, for example, if, you know, you got to make yourself feel better. Would you say that the different languages also lead to, like, maybe similar forms of thinking or forms of doing things culturally?
This is interesting. So this is an argument that I think Noam Chomsky iterates in one of his very, very many works. And it, you know, again, kind of comes back to what we were discussing earlier about how some languages seem to fill gaps that others don't necessarily know that they have. To me, it seems that we have sort of a Gordian knot of which comes first, right? Does language form the way that we think, or does the way that we think form language? And it's a very difficult and very slippery slope, because if we start to think of language determinism, then that can be utilized to argument for certain hierarchy of languages, which are false, I think. I think that every language offers something unique, and I think languages are born and utilized within social contexts that shift over time, right? So I think for the Greeks who are saying, hey, Latin is so similar to our language, it's basically like we were conquered by our cousins, so it's not a big deal. They're utilizing language politically, but they're also doing that purposefully rather than saying, oh, you know, because we speak the same language or we speak sibling languages or cousin languages, it's inevitable that we would be a part of this, the same empire, right? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
Christopher, please chime in.
So, yeah, the notion that language determines what we're able to think is what really interests me. And I brought in this book called Language, Thought, and Reality by Benjamin Lee Whorf, who makes this thesis explicitly using the Hopi language and so forth. When I was reading this, I was living in Lisbon. I had near native fluency in Portuguese. You could start on French and Spanish, and I thought, okay, I sort of get this. Now, I'm not feeling that difference in a restriction in the way I would think in any of those languages. So let me try something else. The time I had a visit from someone who was very politically involved, I was choosing between Chinese and Japanese, and he said, oh, you can't learn Japanese, those capitalists, you know. And of course, I went and then studied Chinese at the University of Paris, where there were 1,000 first-year students of Chinese who were all there because they wanted to be Red Guards. They wanted to. They were Maoists.
The Cultural Revolution.
They were Maoists during the Cultural Revolution. This was back a ways. Well, it worked for me. One of his, Whorf's primary theses is that languages divide space in time. I mean, these are basic concepts, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the Latin-based languages have quite a sophisticated way of saying, well, yes, 2 years ago, but before then, and before then, and even before then, and then after that before type of thing, which is, we take it for granted, you know, even in English, even though we don't have the formal conjugations that the Latin-based languages do. But in Chinese, there are essentially three
adverbial time markers.
Yeah, exactly. You can say, okay, it's happening, it stopped happening, or it will happen. That's it. At one point, I tried to actually interpret in this school that I was in, the National Institute for Oriental Languages. They have an interpreting sort of program. And I did some kind of self-testing of interpreting between English and French. It was possible. I mean, it's extraordinarily stressful in terms of your cognitive machine. But when I tried to translate from Chinese to French, I immediately got this massive migraine. It was just not. People do it in diplomatic circles. They're mostly Chinese. It's very rare to have American interpreters be able to make that leap and frame a Chinese expression of time, space, and all the other content that's going into the message, make that back and forth. Anyway, this was, for me, this was a kind of a seminal moment, the notion that, you know, what, I might think I was clever, but I could only be as clever as the languages I knew. I couldn't be Chinese clever, really. I couldn't be Hopi clever, and so forth. And anyway, this is, you know, what does it mean to use a certain language to think, much less write or translate, you know? So.
Do you sometimes find that there are some ideas you can only think of in one of the languages you know? They don't work in another language?
I think that's true, although the languages in which I'm really fluent, I mean, I've finished a degree in Chinese, but that was, it's not fresh anymore. 但是我的中文不错了。So I
we'll have to include subtitles.
No, I think to your point, to one of your many points here, there are always things that are difficult to capture fully from one language to another. But I guess I have the follow-up question. When these difficulties occur in translations, I have to ask myself sometimes if I'm struggling with grammar and syntax, right? The framing of the language itself, which to your point about Mandarin and Cantonese with these time markers versus tenses, which inflected languages in European descent have different tenses and aspects structured built into the languages. Yeah. Or if it is to Worf's point, a system of thought that is reflected as different. And to me, I love this title of the book. I'm looking at it right now as Language, Thought, and Reality, because to me, language is one way in which we approach reality, right? And so we might have a language that doesn't allow us to express temporality beyond just now, now, and soon to come. But we still live in the same time-space continuum as people who have inflected languages that have, I used to be able to do this, I was starting to do this, I will in the future have done this, right? Which is something that is much more Latinate or Greek or Germanic. And to me, the fact that we live in a world where we're constantly, even in spaces that seem to be carved out as more monolingual, to me, we are still exposed to people who are speaking different languages and utilizing time in different ways. So I wonder, I don't like to think of this as restrictive. I like to think of these languages as being mutually buoying one another up, if that makes sense, right? The opportunities that you have to express time in Mandarin contrasted with the opportunities you have to express time in German compared to what you can do with...